If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, everybody. Hey, we're with Bo and Yang today.
Hi.
On the Late Night Podcast.
Hello.
And you were on the show last night.
I was.
And we're doing the podcast today.
Yes.
And this is all very easy because you work just upstairs at SNL.
I work just upstairs. I came down the elevator bank, middle of a studio tour. Felt very pilot episode of 30 Rock.
Yeah. Because you probably aren't quite at the point where you're recognizable to a studio tour.
No.
Yet.
So it was great. It was great to like just hear the pages like do the same part of that script when they get to like the cast photo, like the original cast.
Yep.
Not ready for primetime people, and they're just go, who can name all, you know, the, it was at that point.
You were at that point in the tour?
Yeah.
For those who don't know, you did a full year as a writer on the show before you
became
a cast member. Mm-hmm. How was that transition? Do you look back and say, oh my God, I'm so glad I had a year as a writer, or do you think it made it harder?
No, 100% was glad that I had the year as a writer. Just because you, I feel like I would make the argument that the writers have the hardest job, and it was just a nice little crucible for me to like walk through, and then just know it, just like feeling like the most abject depression at like things not getting picked or things not making it past dressed, I think was just very, very, very educational, I think. And then now I'm not super surprised by anything anymore.
I went the opposite direction.
Right.
I started as a cast member and then became a writer on the show.
Yeah.
And then I was basically just doing writing an update as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think going the way I went, I did learn a lot more when I became a writer. In that, I had these years as a cast member where I would often think, no one's writing for me.
Uh-huh.
This is so unfair. Uh-huh. And then you become a writer where that is basically how you're identified with the show.
Right.
And you have no time to think about taking care of anyone else.
No.
Like, the reality is you did not write for somebody because you were judging them or anything.
It was just because you could only write so much, and you have producers telling you, oh, maybe only work on these two things.
Yeah, of course.
And they're usually just, like, your strongest ideas that aren't specifically, like, molded around a cast member.
And you're in a full, also, white-hot panic as well.
Yeah.
And it would be a little bit like running out of a burning house and someone saying, you didn't bring the lamp? I wasn't thinking about the lamp.
Oh, that's perfect.
I didn't hate the lamp.
It's just the house is on fire. But, I mean, we're recording on a Tuesday.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know what your process was on Tuesday.
Yeah, so Tuesday's the writing night.
Yeah.
And you will be writing for the Christmas show.
Yes.
With host Eddie Murphy.
Yes.
My process, the longer I was at the show, was I would just think all day.
Uh-huh.
I did a lot of thinking, yeah.
Yeah.
I got worse and worse at starting pieces.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's
and
scary.
A lot of people get better. I think the longer the show, the older they get, the more they're like, I'm going to write one on Monday, and I'm going to write one on Tuesday, and I'm going to get a good night's sleep.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of times, I would have maybe half a piece done, and at 3 in the morning, I would fall asleep on my couch for 3 hours, and then I would wake up and fever write for 6 hours.
This is by the end.
This is by the end.
Of your tenure.
Yeah.
That's terrifying.
It was terrifying.
Oh, no.
It
gets worse.
It does. Seems like maybe less people sleep at the office now.
No, I mean, supervising writers definitely do.
Okay.
So Sudi, Anna, Streeter, Fran definitely do their overnights there.
Good.
They have their little kit there. But yeah, I think, no, actually what's I mean, this is very esoteric, very inside baseball, but maybe people are interested. There's this weird cultural shift now where people are like, I'm going to leave at 11 and work on this from home.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's only like a small little subset of the writers who are doing that, but like I couldn't.
Oh, no.
Because as soon as I go home, I just have to.
Yeah, home. And I do think it's, and by the way, I'm no judgment if people can manage it, but I would never want to bring that energy of having to write sketches home.
Did you ever do the thing when you were cast, at least? Well, maybe this was different back then, but like a lot of times what people do now is they wake up Wednesday morning at like 10 to like do like another couple passes like from bed on their laptops.
No, and
like,
I couldn't do that.
It's hard. It's tough.
Yeah.
I hate it.
I think my seventh show Hugh Jackman hosted, and it was the first night that I stayed the whole night, and I got three sketches picked. Only, I think, one aired, but I was the hottest read-through I ever had. And
great.
And then after that, I was like, now I sleep here.
Yeah.
I sleep here on Tuesdays now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Who do you share an office with?
With Anna Dresden.
Oh, great.
Very good friend from college, supervising writer now, genius.
So great. I believe she wrote one of my favorite sketches of last year, the Adam Sandler travel ad. Was that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, my God. Great. I love that ad so much. It was, yeah, so good. Just so real. Yeah, great.
You had, so not just college, but also just the comedy scene.
Uh-huh.
When you showed up, there were friendly faces. Anna, Sudi Green.
Yes.
Julio Torres.
Julio, yeah. I just kind of lucked out with, like, people I hung out with, or people who would just like you would run into at like a bar basement show or something.
And they all seem very nice.
So nice. The nicest people. And like Julio is funny because he's pretty, he's kind of like, he's a writer, actor, producer, has his own show. And like he gives off this sort of mystical drag.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, I don't know how to crack Julio. Like, how do you talk to him? And you're just like, he's a normal human being. Just like start a conversation as you normally would with anyone else.
With that said, man, I wish I gave off more of a mystical drag. I'm very easy to talk to, but I would love people to think there was something to crack.
Same. I feel it's too late for me to go back to like, I don't know.
They're like, look, if you're having trouble with Julio, just strike up a conversation with Bowen. He'll talk to anyone.
Yep.
We didn't have time to get to it the other day. But you, was it with Julio that you wrote the Sara Lee sketch
for
Harry Styles?
Yes.
This was a sketch that I feel like both was really funny in the seeing, and then it had this fun sort of tail to it in that Sara Lee, you know, is a real company.
Real company.
And you, for those who didn't see the sketch, Harry Styles played somebody who ran the Sara Lee Instagram account and then would sometimes mess up his comments with his private account.
Yes. And we wrote this last season, season 44. It was Julio's idea, and Julio was just like, let's write something. Like, it was right around the time when, like, Sunny D, like, all these, like, brand Twitter accounts would, like, tweet these, like, very depressed sentiments. Like, it started with Sunny D tweeting, like, really think I can't do this anymore. Like, I think I gotta... And it was bleak. And then, like, Twitter would just sort of, like, have, like, their day with, like, just laughing at it or, like, quote tweeting it or something. And then... So then Julio was just like, let's just write it. And it was when Mulaney hosted... And we wrote it for Mulaney, and the brand back then was Nestle, because Julio wanted a brand that was just, at that point, Julio wanted a brand that was kind of like a cipher, like you could just project anything you wanted onto it. Nestle's pretty like, I don't know, it's just an unembellished brand, and it was just all these chocolate pictures that we did, and then it was with Mulaney, and he did great, it made it to Dress, and then there were just shots were missed and stuff, and like it cut off at the caption so the audience couldn't see it. On the monitor, and so it just didn't work.
Yeah.
And then Mulaney DMs us the next day, goes, I'm so sorry that didn't go. You guys should try to resub it for another host. And at that point, it was like April or March or something. So, like, there weren't that many episodes left in the season. But then Julio left at the end of last season, but then I got cast, and then Harry Styles was coming. We were just like, let's resub it for Harry. And then we went home one day. On a Sunday, we did a show together. The Sunday before Harry Styles came, we went to his place, ordered sushi, and just, like, rewrote it and just had to, like, Mad Lib in. But, oh, because this is this whole thing now. Everyone on Twitter has this, like, conspiracy theory around, like, oh, these are all product placements. Truly, it's just we just, like, willy-nilly pick a brand.
Right.
Yeah, which wasn't the case for this because Julio was very, very, very sort of fastidious about, like, which was the perfect brand for this sketch because we, like, Mad Libbed in a bunch of different things. We did, like... Cadbury, we did Kellogg's, General Mills. I'm like, no, like, why did General Mills say spit in my mouth? Like, we had like try out and audition different brands, and then we landed on Sara Lee. And
it just was Sara Lee because it, I think there's that weird thing of as only being a part of the sketch as a viewer, Sara Lee makes perfect sense to me. When you came up with it, did you realize, aha,
Yeah, it clicked then because we were really just throwing everything against it. And then Sara Lee was, it's this wholesome bread company. Like, it's so funny.
How do you feel Sara Lee has felt in the...
At first, so what happened was they shut down their comments and their likes.
Right, yeah.
And that made me sad.
Yep.
And then their PR was like, well, no, we just had to do that for like at least an hour just to figure out what the hell was going on.
Sure.
And then now they've reopened it, and they took a bit of a hiatus in posting stuff, but now they've been posting a lot of stuff for Christmas and recipes, and it's still happening, and I kind of feel bad.
Yeah.
I kind of feel bad that all their comments are these lewd blue things. I don't know. But then they sent us like a peace offering. They sent us a basket of artisanal bread and butter bread and Texas
toast. See, that's weird that they would feel the need to make peace with you since you were the ones that committed the crime against them.
like, what could we do? Like, there's no olive branch from us. Like,
you could send them like a sweatshirt. You could be like, hey, who runs? Whoever is the guy who we Harry Styles played. That
For sure. Yeah, we could have sent a prop over.
You should send them also just a different artisanal bread.
Yes, absolutely. It was fun. It was a fun little sort of flare up on social media.
That was a great sketch idea. I'm always enjoying asking people what their worst ones. Yes. Do you have any worst sketch ideas?
Yeah, I wrote one for Claire Foy last season that it's just like a hacky premise, but apparently it made it onto the board during the meeting on
Wednesday. Oh, that's
exciting.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
The board is like, for those who don't know, in the room after read-through, there are like 40 sketches to choose from. Yep. Maybe 15 are discussed. Mm-hmm. That means you're on the board.
That means you're on the board.
Yeah.
And so it's being considered.
Yeah.
And this is, I feel like I dodged a bullet because it was just this hacky song about like premium economy. It was just like Claire Foy like pretending she was like very luxurious walking around an airport and like asking for amenities. And they were like, oh, no, that's... We don't offer that for, like, you can't access the lounge. It was just kind of like a basic thing. And I tried to resub it for this season and, like, looked back at it. Oh, do you ever have this thing? I look back at writing that I've done, like, even just as recently as, like, a year ago, and I'll think, wow, like, this is trash. This is bad, 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 bad.
We, my last week,
yes,
Colin Jost organized a surprise party for me on Thursday.
Great.
But one of the things he did, which was incredibly sweet, was he printed up every script I ever wrote.
Wow.
It was like 500 sketches. And it was basically wallpaper. And I mean, my first reaction was, this is the greatest thing ever. And then just like, as I got a little drunk, I'd go over and look at him and be like, oh, get this off the wall.
It's terrible.
This is not for people to see.
It's bad. It's so jarring. And, but yeah, that's one that comes to mind. And then like, I just have a bunch of like pitches that I thought should have gone over better. And like, they just got no laughs.
But the worst thing is, I don't know if this has happened to you yet, where a fake pitch that you have no intention of writing goes so well that you then feel the burden to write it.
Right.
And then it tanks the way you knew it would always tank.
Because you kind of give it away in pitch on Monday.
Well, that's the thing. A good fake pitch is a thing that will get a laugh.
Yes.
That would not make a good sketch.
Exactly.
But this isn't even that good. So I'm not saying like people who are listening to this podcast are going to have to pull over their cars for laughter. But my first year, I pitched at Alec Baldwin. You have a lake house and the lake is banning jet skis. So you're taking your jet ski for one last ride.
Great.
And then all Monday and all Tuesday, every time I passed him, he said, you better be writing up jet ski.
Oh, no.
And then I wrote it up and it went exactly as badly as I thought it would do. And then right after read-through, he walked by me and said, I had higher hopes for jet ski.
Oh, my God.
So that was a lesson learned.
Mortifying. Terrible, terrible.
He was right, by the way, at every step of the way. So you, we talked about this. You've lived a lot of places. You grew up in Colorado.
Uh-huh.
Was performing something you started doing at a young age?
Yeah. I was a really, really gross, hammy kid. And growing up in a household where that was like not at all encouraged.
Siblings,
one older sister who like introduced me to SNL and like explained to me, like, because we just moved from Canada in 99 and it was, we didn't get in Canada, and like truly like the only thing that we watched, the only comedy that I knew of was like, they would air Monty Python every now and then, but like it was truly like Mr. Bean was like,
right,
what I like glommed onto, it like what imprinted on me at an early age. And then moving to the US, like, just had a lot of cultural catching up to do. And then like truly like the way in was SNL was just like,
and how old are you then?
9.
Okay, so 9, yeah.
So yeah, this is like right at the end of, or no, right at the beginning of Tina being, yep, on Update. Yeah. So that was like a very sort of critical time for me. And then, so watched SNL and Mad TV like equally. Picked up, we did not have cable, so I had to like adjust the antennas for Fox and then for NBC on Saturdays. Just for, yeah. And it was, I just made it like a ritual every week to watch it. And then there was a short form improv group in high school that like I made it my mission to get on.
You had to audition for it.
Had to audition for it.
Got it.
The calculus teacher and the epistemology teacher at our high school did short form on the side in downtown Denver. Very good. Adrian Holguin, he's still a good friend. And he did not get accepted. I did not get on the group my freshman year. Got on sophomore year. There were just as many politics back then as there are now at SNL.
Yeah.
There's just a crazy, weird stratification of like people and like what their roles were. And then when I was looking at colleges, like, I would go on the college tours, and at the end, like, I would go to Northwestern, and at the end, they'd be like, okay, any questions? And I'd be like, yeah, so, like what would you say, like, out of the Titanic players, like, who are, like, I would just, like, ask, like, the most, the craziest questions about comedy and improv to the tour guides who, like, had no idea what I was talking about.
I went to Northwestern. I did not get into my improv troupe until my fourth year, until senior year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I don't, and I always say this because it's true, they were never wrong. Like, it was only 8
sure.
people.
Yep.
And those shows, freshman, sophomore, junior, every time I saw it, I could never pick the person that I deserved to be.
Wow.
But that made me very ambitious to like, and also want to be better. So that's when I started taking improv classes.
Great.
In Chicago.
Great.
Was, I can't do this if I don't get better.
Learned, yeah.
And so did you do it at college as well?
I did in college. I had that same sort of like really scary ambition to do it, because it was down between like NYU and UCLA, and then researched the NYU improv group and like saw their taped sets on YouTube and like
really
researched the rosters. And then Anna Drezin, I like messaged her on Facebook in April of 2008 before I was matriculating, and I was like, hey, I'm going to be majoring in chemistry, and I'm going to be pre-med at NYU. Does that put me at a disadvantage to get into the improv group? Please let me know. Also, do you do UCBs? I was that kid. Like, I made it, like, it was very important to me that, like, I got involved in
it. Did she write back?
She did, and she wrote back, like, the nicest message. It was like, we have our Welcome Week show, come to that, and we'll meet, and all this stuff. And it was truly, like, a faded interaction.
So you mentioned chemistry. You were pre-med. When do you cleave away from that as your life path?
Like, literally 2 months after I graduated. Sonia
Soto. Oh, but you went through all pre-med.
Went through all pre-med, took my MCAT, had my applications in, and your segment producer, Henry Melcher, who's sitting, yes, next to me, just, like, knew me, went, like, saw me through this. I was miserable, yeah, and just had to, just, like, went through this, like, crazy, crazy, like, transfiguration in my mind about like what I was gonna do with my life, and like decided to like pull out my applications, and like,
you took the MCAT.
I took the MCAT.
Did you do well?
I did pretty well.
Okay, gotcha.
I got like a 34.
Okay, how, like, on a scale of what? What's a good,
like, that's like a, like a, anything above a 30 is great. Like a 34 is like a 93rd percentile.
Okay,
or something.
Gotcha. So you had it. This,
yeah,
isn't a situation where you were going to be a bad doctor.
I could have been a
bad,
like,
doctor. And you like are like now making it seem like, oh yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. It was this moment, because so Sonia Sotomayor spoke at our graduation. That's not important, but I was sitting with the Tisch kids. I was sitting with the kids who were in the art school that, like, I was mostly friends with anyway when I was in college. And then I looked around, and they were all so excited,
right,
to, like, move on to the next thing, and I wasn't. And I was like, oh, I picked the wrong thing.
Although that's so funny when you think of percentage-wise,
mm-hmm,
someone who gets a 34 in their MCAT, their ceiling's so much higher than people who are graduating from an arts.
but even then, like, I felt like I like really, I like,
well,
I,
it's about passion. That's why it's
totally
more fun to hang out with people who are, you know, they have low odds, but they're going into it enthusiastically.
Right?
It's the best. They're the best people in the world to hang out with.
I would rather have the low odds, to be honest.
Yeah, of course.
And so commencement was when I realized I had done the wrong thing, which is awful. Like, the worst possible place you could
But like not, I mean, it's lucky that you did like have this parallel existence as an improviser while you're being a pre-med student. Exactly. So it wasn't like the kid who realized, oh, if I could do freshman year over again, I would have done the improv group.
Right. I ended up doing what I loved doing while I was at school. I just sort of had 2 feet in different place, like each foot in a different place, and just had to pick a side on the balance beam. Or, you know, like my metaphors are being mixed.
I imagine it was hard. Is that a hard call to your parents?
It was a terrible, it was a very hard call to my parents. They didn't understand it for a while. They gave me like a year and a half to like make it work on my own, and or else they were like, you're going to move back if you don't.
Gotcha. So and did they set that? Did they say, we think 18 months is around the right time?
Oh, that's... Basically, they were like, we can help you out with money for a little bit, but you have to make this work in New York. Great. Yeah.
So. And timeline-wise, because I don't know exactly how fast it happened for you. So 18 months after that decision, are things going well enough that you no longer doubt your decision?
They weren't. I was just making my own money. I just had like, I locked down a day job that still gave me time to like write and do all this other stuff. So kind of, I still like was pounding the pavement for like another like 5 years after that, I would say. Yeah. But yeah, I'm just very glad I stayed.
You talk in your stand-up about going through conversion therapy. Uh-huh, and I was wondering, like, was that a difficult thing to find a way to make humorous, or was it an important thing for you to talk about because of the own catharsis for you?
Yeah, for sure. It was... Or it's just a way to show people that it's like a manageable thing. I feel like the mental model for like someone who's been through conversion therapy is, well, wow, they're like a broken person at this point. Or like they've lost something about themselves, or they've been held back and their development is like a queer person. And I feel like I don't really think, if anything, it's conferred good things. And I haven't really felt like I've been held back in any way. And so, yeah, it was just important for me to, like, show people, hey, awful traumatic thing happened to me. But, like, look, I'm fine. I'm totally fine.
And I imagine you must get feedback from people who've been in similar situations when you do material like that.
Yeah, for sure. And it's really nice. And it's, like, a shared experience that you don't see too often being, like, thrown out there.
Certainly never, when you see it, it is not thrown out with any comic underpinnings.
No.
And I think that, speaking to you, talking about how it can be both traumatic and a thing you survive without losing your identity.
Right.
I think that's where it's nice to have, deal with it through a comic lens.
Totally, because it's great to like have like the boy erased like version of it.
Sure.
But then it's also, I think you have to like round it out with like something that's slightly frivolous or just kind of like trivializes it in a way that like doesn't sell out either.
It's a companion piece, as
you've
always
said. Companion piece to Boy Erased. Yes. That's what my stand-up is.
You say in the beginning of each of your stand-up bits, like, the best dramatic version of this that you should also watch
is Boy Erased, starring Lucas Hedges, Nicole Kidman.
You have a very popular podcast with your friend Matt Rogers.
Yes. Right.
And, how many years have you been doing that? And
we're on four. We've been doing it for a full presidential term.
And have you, has it been, it must be nice to do something that sort of gains listeners over the time.
Yeah, for sure. And we started out, we kind of built it from the ground up with this like fledgling network back then, Forever Dog. And now they're like producing the National Lampoon Radio Hour reboot and like all this stuff. Like they're doing amazing things. And it was just, I find it really nice that like we were able to just sort of like start from nothing. Truly, it wasn't like a big network getting us or anything. We just like really laid each brick like on.
And how did you guys meet?
Matt and I through college. He was in the sketch group. I was in the improv group. We were both like we were both the homosexual in each group. And so people would try to like, people would be like, you guys should be friends. And we were like, no. And then when we finally started to hang out, we were like, oh, wait, no, they were right. Like, this is like a faded friendship, too.
I do want to provide you this opportunity because it is truly incredible.
Uh-huh.
Name some of the people you went to college with at the same time.
At the same time? Okay. Sudie Green, Anna Dresden, Rachel Bloom. Donald Glover would come to the sketch shows because he had just graduated, like, 2 years before. Rachel Brosnahan would also come to shows. John Early would come to the shows. And it was just this, like, crazy, crazy, like, convocation of people. Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's great.
And it's paid off.
It's paid off.
It's paid off. And you do, and you like still that. Do, you do give a little bit of, not a lot, but a little bit of medical advice at SNL. Just.
Yes, I do. And I explain valences to people.
Yeah. If Lauren gets a weird mole, he's like, get Bowen.
Can I get Bowen? Just,
hey, thank you so much, for being here. I so enjoy watching you on the show. Have a great Christmas show.
Thank you so much. And then a great holiday. You have a great holiday. Thanks, Seth.
All right. Mo-dang, everybody.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loreau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.